This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
No fluff, no guessing. When CFA Charterholder is on that resume, it means something real. Intensive study, tough exams, relentless drive, true grit, a strong network. Hiring managers get it instantly. The CFA Charter is more than letters after a name. It's proof of discipline, resilience, and integrity under pressure. It shows who you are before you even walk in the room. Explore what the Charterholder Advantage looks like at cfainstitute.org.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The idea is that you and I step into a large room crammed with computers, maps, reference books and top experts whose only job is to give us the most thorough briefing possible on the burning questions of the day. And our question today is Brexit dividing Britain in a dangerous and unprecedented way? And if you enjoy this podcast, you might enjoy other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. For instance, if you've been wondering what the Norway option is, you could always listen to our programme on that. The air is thick with warnings about where the great Brexit quarrel may be taking us as a people. If I've heard one warning of civil disturbance or bitter dissension if X or Y happens, I've heard 100. And today the chairman of the National Police Chiefs Council warned of an incredibly febrile atmosphere and asked individuals that have a platform and have a voice not to inflame people's views. So today in the briefing room, I want to know what the evidence is for these worries and what history suggests about the truth of the proposition that we're in danger of some kind of social meltdown. Step inside the briefing room to find out. First, what is it that makes Brexit so uniquely divisive? Or is it symptomatic of other shifts underway in the British population? The Briefing Room's Serena Tarling has been speaking to Professor Sarah Hobolt from the London School of Economics, who's been looking at the impact of Brexit on national identity, and the sophologist Professor Sir John Curtis from the University of Strathclyde.
The two most popular options are either to leave without a deal or to hold another referendum in the hope and expectation that we will change our minds. And that therefore gives you indication that within this fractured environment, it is the polar ends, it's the more extreme options that are the most popular.
We gave people a standard question about whether you would feel comfortable or uncomfortable about your daughter or your son marrying a Leaver or Remainer. And we see that people are more reluctant to see their daughter or son marrying someone from the other group.
John Curtis's polling suggests your allegiance to a political party is no indication of your position on Brexit.
People of left-wing views were just as likely to vote Leave as were those of right-wing views in the Brexit referendum. Rather, it's the argument is between those whom we might want to call social liberals and those that we might want to call social conservatives. Social liberals are essentially those people who say, look, at the end of the day, it's up to the individual to decide what social mores they follow, what religion they adhere to. And they're people who are quite comfortable living in a multicultural, multi-ethnic, multilinguistic environment. The other end of the spectrum are those who say, look, actually, if a society is going to cohere, then it does, to some degree, need to enforce a moral code upon its members. And these also tend to be people who feel rather uncomfortable about a multilinguistic, multicultural, multi-ethnic environment. Social conservatives strongly voted to leave. Social liberals strongly voted to remain.
And he says this division is replicated across the demographic and geographical divides.
At one end of the spectrum, we have young people who've been to university, and if they live in London, they frankly wonder what the argument about the European Union is about. So people used to living in one of the world's most diverse societies, who are younger and who have been brought up, and who in going to university have both become culturally attuned to cultural diversity, but also crucially have the kind of labour market skills that are essential to being able to take advantage of the freedom of movement provisions. But at the other end of the spectrum, you have older people, particularly older people who have little in the way of educational qualifications. And they may well live in a part of England which has hitherto not experienced a great deal of immigration. Now, these are people for whom, first of all, immigration can be something of a cultural challenge. These are people who do not necessarily think that immigration is economically advantageous, and they basically therefore are people who are having to accommodate to the consequences of migratory flows into the UK.
Sarah Hobolt has carried out research on what she calls these new Brexit identities.
The psychological processes that we observe when people have an in-group, a social identity, is that they like to have that identity and that in-group reinforced. So they'll tend to observe the world in a way that is in line with what they already think and feel. So that means if you voted Remain, you will tend to perceive all economic information, for example, as in line with the fact that you voted Remain because you thought that leaving the EU would be bad for the economy, and therefore every piece of information that you pick up on the economy will just reinforce that. In contrast, if you voted Leave, the same kind of information will be interpreted in a different way. So you'll think, well, actually, these Remainers, this Project Fear said this would be terrible for the economy, but what we're seeing is actually very little change. So they were wrong. So the same kind of information will be perceived very differently by these two identity groups.
And Brexit has shaped people's perceptions of one another.
In order to look at how Brexit identities have affected prejudice and how people feel about each other, we ask a number of questions about how they would describe the other group. And here we find that both Leavers and Remainers will tend to describe the other group as self-interested, as hypocritical, as close-minded, and equally their other group as open-minded and intelligent. And so we see this asymmetry where people feel a lot of animosity towards the other group and have very little trust in the other group, whereas they feel strongly a strong sense of in-group identity with their own group. What we discovered, to our surprise, was that the Brexit vote mattered more than anything else in terms of deciding whether or not people wanted someone to come and live with them. So it really suggests that Brexit identities and this in-group, out-group feeling spills over into areas that are really not related to politics at all.
But are these Brexit identities a symptom of other longer-term shifts in public opinion?
Brexit has become the issue which has brought to the fore a wider debate in our society. And it's a wider debate, I think, about the process of globalization. What has been true, you know, for the last 10 or 15 years is that the United Kingdom is not unique in this respect, has experienced some consequences of globalization with which not everybody has been happy. One, of course, is the financial crash and the way in which it no longer seems to be guaranteed that the rising tide of economic growth lifts all boats. So there are arguments about, therefore, whether or not economically the tiger of globalization needs to be controlled rather more. And equally, however, the other aspect of globalization, which is immigration, the truth is the UK, which historically has been a country that has usually been a net exporter of population, has experienced high levels of net inward migration. This is a wider debate that's going on, which has caused quite a lot of political disruption elsewhere and is now reaping political havoc within the UK as well.
Serena Tarling with John Curtis and Sarah Hobolt. Here in the briefing room to discuss some of those points are Deborah Mattinson, founding partner of research and strategy consultancy Britain Thinks, and Paula Surridge, senior lecturer in the School of Sociology, Politics and International Studies at the University of Bristol. You just heard John Curtis speaking there about how Brexit is a kind of distillation of pre-existing tensions that have been building up. Paula Surridge, you've been researching for a new publication, Brexit Identities and Divisions, The Left-Right Divide is your chapter in a booklet. What did you discover in the process of writing that that reflects on what John Curtis was saying?
In terms of the Leave and Remain vote in the referendum, our traditional left-right values do not help us, do not predict that. It usually comes as a surprise to people to discover that on that kind of scale of left-rightness, you can't distinguish a UKIP voter from a Green Party voter. They're equally left-wing. But this new divide of social liberal, social conservatism is what predicts referendum vote. But the old divide hasn't gone away completely, and part of what I've been doing is trying to look at how these different divides combine in the electorate to give us different groups of voters.
And what were your major conclusions?
So the major conclusions are that the left-wing vote in particular has been fragmenting, and it's been fragmenting along this liberal-conservative divide. So part of the problem that we see in the Labour Party at the moment, both amongst MPs but particularly amongst its voters, is that they're very divided on this other scale. So although they occupy the same space on economics, on the left-right divide, they're very, very divided between social liberals who primarily voted Remain, and social conservatives who primarily voted Leave.
We've also heard that there's also a generational and educational question. Does that mean that people of almost of the same family, of the same class, one generation will have tended in one direction and the next generation is tending in the other?
The best predictor of this liberal-conservative divide is actually your education level, not your age or your class. So if you have a family where the younger generation have experienced social mobility through education, then they're likely to end up on opposite sides of that divide. But if the younger generation haven't experienced social mobility, haven't been to university, then it's quite likely they'll still be on the same divide.
So the point is, Deborah Mattison, it's just that so many more of them have been to university than the previous generation had.
I was literally about to make that point. I mean, of course, what Paula says is right, but age is a proxy for education in a sense. The older you are, the less likely you are to be a graduate, for example. The younger you are, the more likely you are to be a graduate. So to a certain extent, those things come together. But Paula, of course, is also right that young people who haven't been to university, you know, would have views that are more similar to older people that also haven't been to university than to other young people.
When I was younger, the Great Divide was a class divide, and people talked about Labour being a working class party and the Conservatives being a middle class party. And it would be, broadly speaking, if you knew what somebody earned and where they worked, you'd know who they would vote for. Has this now been entirely superseded by this kind of cultural divide, Deborah?
I don't know if it's been entirely superseded, because I think that there still is a correlation between how much you earn and how you vote. But what I would say is, on this point about the left-right divide, I think it's just really important to flag that most people don't see themselves on that spectrum anyway, and I think kind of never have. So it's a slightly artificial construct, and one that politicians are more likely to adhere to than ordinary members of the public. You make them think about it that way, they're going to stick themselves in the middle.
Paula Surridge, one of the things you might think you notice about the American polity is that the culture wars, what they call the culture wars, have donated a kind of bitterness or a rhetorical savagery sometimes to the internal debate that didn't even really quite exist in the old class-based or left-right discussions.
Yes, I think that's right. And we're seeing some of that starting to feed through into our politics. What we've seen since the 2015 election is that those social liberals who voted Remain have actually become a little bit more liberal over time. So the debate itself is starting to polarise that divide still further, which obviously then contributes to that bitterness, because it makes that divide all the more salient.
Why do you think that's happened?
Well, I call it a kind of activated liberalism. So many of these groups assumed that the rest of the world thought like they did. So there was a widespread assumption at the referendum that Remain would win. And so people assumed that that was going to happen. And then after the referendum, and I think the same process applies after the election of Donald Trump in the US, people realise that actually not everybody does hold these values, and therefore they start to think of those values as being something that they want to protect.
Deborah.
I think you have to look at it from the other point of view as well. I do focus groups in places now where people say to me, of course, we're a left behind community here, and they actually kind of identify that way and feel quite bitter about it. In a poll that we did a couple of years ago, 6 out of 10 of people described themselves as have-nots. There is a very strong sense of resentment on both sides, I think. And, you know, the leavers feel that Remainers are looking at them, looking down on them, and Remainers sort of are looking down on them. I mean, I think that there is really a lot of hostility, particularly with people who hold, if you like, the kind of extreme, more extreme viewpoints, which is a lot of people. I'm not talking about a small amount, you know, about a third of people are very intensely leave, about a third of people are very intensely remain, and they are more likely to feel that hostility.
What you're just both describing there, it seems to me, thinking about it, is the construction of, at least in one part of this discussion, a form of almost a victim mentality, which to say we are being assaulted by the other side, our most cherished values are under assault, and it's not fair.
I think that's right. And I think that there are a group of kind of like working class Leave voters who feel that they have been got at by elites, for want of a better way of describing them, for a long time. And they will talk resentfully about political correctness and stopping your freedom of speech. And what the referendum did was to shine a light on that. It didn't create it.
So, Paula, what that means is that Brexit literally does become this proxy for all these other feelings surrounding one particular decision. And you can locate yourself entirely, almost entirely, on the basis of this, how this one particular decision plays out.
Yes, I think that's right. And I agree with what Deborah's saying. These are long-standing divides. I can trace them in survey data, certainly back to 2010 and probably before that as well. So they weren't created by the referendum. But the referendum gives a really easy point of reference for them. It crystallises them and it allows you to have an easy label to apply to it as well.
It's given it voice and it's given it a vocabulary as well that people can easily access.
Well, I was going to ask you precisely about that. You do a lot of focus groups and so on. What linguistic changes have you seen in the way in which people describe themselves and particularly the other? Because what I'm really getting at here is the proposition that we're beginning to move into rather dangerous, febrile atmosphere.
I think that's right. I think people are quite angry. I think people are, you know, feel a sense of hostility and they feel very worried about it. The poll that we've just done shows that 64% of people feel that the Brexit debate is bad for their mental health. They feel that worried about it. 70% of women think it. And that's partly, I think, something that was discussed earlier, the kind of hostility intergenerational in the same family, I think, is a problem. Another thing I would flag is that I find that people talk more openly about being racist. And that's something that I wouldn't have experienced and wouldn't have heard 10, 20 years ago. And now in focus groups, I did one fairly recently where actually at the end of the focus group, two of the women were just chatting to one another. And one of them turned to the other and she said, oh, yeah, my husband, he's a racist. And she said it as if she was saying he's an Arsenal supporter. It was said in a very matter-of-fact way. And I was extremely taken aback by that.
Well, Paula, that raises the question about whether or not the debate isn't animating and allowing expressions of dislike that previously people have suppressed.
I agree, but having spent some time in various kind of working class communities, anybody that spends time in those informally knows that those kinds of positions never went away. You know, you would hear racist and homophobic language being used quite normally in kind of family gatherings and things like that. And people felt that that was closed down, though, that they couldn't say it outwardly. And that, obviously, if Deborah's picking that up in her focus groups, that's definitely a change.
Can we just talk about, finally, the idea of what happens when these things are expressed? If there is an expression of extremism on either side, which breaks out into, I don't know, civil disobedience and violence, is it the case, you think, Deborah, that other people would turn round and say, well, actually, now we've had a look at that, we're going to pull back from it?
I think people would draw a real distinction, actually, thinking about what you've just said, between saying something and then doing something physical about it. So, and that line would be obviously around kind of physical action. And people are quite afraid of that, I think. And I think people genuinely feel afraid of what the future holds at the moment and concerned about it. And that's true across... That's one thing that unites everybody, actually. And I think the other thing that unites people is a desire for unity, ironically, given where we are at the moment. But one of the things, if I say to people, what do you want, what do you most want in the next couple of years? They say, for the country to come together.
I'm angry, but I want unity.
Yeah, yeah.
Deborah Mattinson there and Paula Surridge. Finally, let's take an even more Olympian view. The trends that lead to great, even cataclysmic change can be hard to spot when you're in the middle of events. If we were to compare our situation with those faced by people in the past, would that help our understanding? On the line now from Toronto is Margaret McMillan, Emeritus Professor of International History at Oxford University. Margaret McMillan, as a historian observing our current tribulations, you've just been listening to them, what precedents have suggested themselves to you?
It's hard to think of an exact one like this. I mean, it's hard to think of a country which somehow has done this to itself and seems incapable of reaching a decision. I know sometimes people are talking about Weimar Germany. That seems to come up a bit. And it was also a deeply divided polity where you had people opposed bitterly over issues of what sort of society they wanted, what sort of politics they wanted, what sort of foreign policy they wanted.
This is the democratic Germany between the wars.
This is the democratic Germany that was founded just at the end of the First World War and which lasted until Hitler destroyed it in 1933. So it had a very short life. You always think if it had had more time, it would have put down stronger roots, and with the passage of time, people would have got used to it. But there was a lot of unhappiness with Weimar and a lot of tendency, which I think you see now, to blame everything that was going wrong on the Treaty of Versailles that Germany had signed at the end of the First World War and to blame everything on the Weimar Republic. A lot of that wasn't reasonable. But I think it's much the same way that people now blame the European Union for everything they don't like in their current situation. And they either think remaining or getting out will somehow settle everything. And that's dangerous. I think when you simplify politics like that so that there's just one cause of your discontent and one solution to your discontent, then you miss what is really the essence of politics, and that's finding a middle ground and muddling through.
Well, that's very interesting. So going back to the question of precedents, what precedents can you think of for the one cause, one solution type situation that we've managed to get ourselves into?
Well, I think you've had it in the United States a bit with Donald Trump. You know, close the border with Mexico and everything's going to be fine, or have a trade war with China and everything is going to be fine. This oversimplifies what are very complex situations, but you can see why they're very appealing. And I think we've seen it in history with conspiracy theories. The Jews are plotting to take over the world. Everything that goes wrong, you can trace back to this Jewish plot. I mean, the infamous Protocols of Zion, which was a forgery done by the Tsarist government. A lot of people believed in at the time, and a lot of people still on the fringes believe that somehow someone is pulling the strings in the as a plot. It goes deep into human nature and human history, this search for a single group of people, a single person, a single cause. You know, it simplifies things. And in some ways, that's reassuring because we don't have to deal with the complexity of the world.
And what about what it tells us about ourselves as a country and the stage we're at?
Well, you know, the more I see it, and again, I speak very much as an outsider, but who also spends a lot of time in the UK, I think what we're seeing partly is an existential crisis of the English. I think the Scots more or less know who they are and seem clearer about what they want and where they want to go. And the Irish, of course, are divided, but they are also the Irish. And it seems to me the English are worrying about who they are. I mean, this sudden appearance of the Cross of St. George, which I never remember before in my life, and this talk about English history and Englishness, and this feeling that somehow England has lost something. I mean, a lot of the debate around leave or remain, particularly on the leave side, involved history, looking back to a time when Britannia ruled the seas. But it seems to me it's partly about being English. And what is it to be English? Dean Acheson, the American Secretary of State in the 50s, said, and it was unkind, but he said, Britain has lost an empire and has yet to find a role. And I think that's something the English perhaps are feeling particularly.
That's an interesting question because I kind of feel that when I was at school, Englishness was seen as a superiority, not insofar as it was defined at all, not as something that was under threat or was problematic. I mean, in fact, it was so superior you didn't really even have to talk about it.
But I think that feeling of being under threat has come. And I think it's come partly from a sense that Britain as a whole, with England at its core, is no longer as powerful and influential as it once was, and that in giving up sovereignty or some form of sovereignty to the European Union, and of course it's given up sovereignty, Britain's given up sovereignty in many ways. Joining military alliances, you give up sovereignty. Joining the IMF, International Monetary Fund, you give up sovereignty. But somehow it's coalesced around the European Union that Britain no longer controls its own fate and no longer counts as much. I mean, I find a lot of the Brexit talk, I mean, those who welcome Brexit, is around how Britain will once again resume its place on the global scene. It will become a leader again. And so I think there's a sense of something lost and a hope that somehow that's going to be regained.
One of the reasons we decided to do this programme was because of the proposition that the current debate could possibly lead us into a situation of civil disobedience, civil dissent, and that we were in any case becoming more polarised. When you look at societies in the past that have effectively destroyed their own democratic institutions or have dipped into civil dissension and civil discord, what do we see?
Well, each society does it in different ways. I mean, I'm always struck when the French have a civil dispute, they tend to go back to some of the, almost literally, the images of the earlier revolutions, the French Revolution, the Revolution of 1830, the Revolution of 1848, and they put up barricades and they make speeches. So I think each nation, in a funny way, has its own vocabulary of dissent. And the British haven't really had much violent public dissent for a long time, but you sure had a lot in the 19th century. You know, you had marches, you had times when shops were looted, windows were smashed. I mean, we still get it a bit. I mean, I can remember anti-Vietnam demonstrations in London. But the British way of protesting seems to be, on the whole, in the 20th century and 21st century, certainly more peaceable than it has been in the past and continues to be in other countries. I mean, I think, on the whole, you prefer to settle your disputes by talking and arguing with each other. And I was very struck in that big march a week ago, the Remain March, by how funny so many of the signs were. I mean, you do still have a sense of humour, and I think this is possibly a saving grace.
Are you saying that compared with other times and other places, there is still likely to be a resilience about British institutions that will keep us from each other's throats?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I always am struck when I'm in the United Kingdom by how civil people are to each other and how willing they are to listen to each other. I mean, I know that this whole debate around the remaining or leaving the European Union has really polarized things. And I know that people are preferring not to talk to people who they know will disagree with them because they just find it so upsetting. And that, I think, is very disturbing. But it seems to me you still have a very active media who have tried to present the different sides, on the whole, reasonably successfully. And I think you do still have an essential civility where people will talk to each other. I mean, I cannot believe this is going to lead to fisticuffs in the street. There may be a few pub brawls, but then there always are.
But historically, can you slip into these things almost by accident?
Well, you can, and I think it's dangerous, as the panelists were saying earlier on, when you get the rhetoric getting inflamed, when you get those on the other side who disagree with you being described as idiots or traitors or somehow criminal. And that is dangerous, because once we start to use that sort of rhetoric, it becomes easier to dehumanize the other people, to say, well, they don't really count. They're not like us because they have broken some sort of unwritten law or they're somehow evil. And so, yeah, I think there is a worry in the rhetoric that's being used at the moment.
What kind of leadership do you think, looking at historical parallels, a country in our situation needs? What are the qualities that we would best be looking for?
Well, you'd be looking for good leaders, but I think what you'd also be looking for is a willingness on the part of those political elites who happen to be in charge at the moment to compromise with each other. I mean, you know, there have been huge crises in the history of democratic countries before, including that of Britain, where people have come together to form national governments or to form coalitions. In the First World War and in the Second World War, you had national governments which brought the parties together and worked, I think, very successfully for the good of the country as a whole. In France in the 1930s, when it looked like there really was a danger of civil war between the conservative and liberal and left-wing forces, you got a Popular Front government which did try and bring different political parties together to provide stable government. So it can be done. Whether there's the willingness to do it in Westminster at the moment, of course, is another question, but I think it's something they really should be considering.
Margaret Macmillan. And I suppose my conclusion has to be, don't panic, take the rhetoric down, but be aware of the dangers. My thanks to Deborah Mattinson, Paula Surridge,
Margaret McMillan, Sarah Hobolt and John Curtis. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirsty Knight, Neil Koenig and Serena Tarling. The production coordinator was Iki Egbetola and the editor was Jasper Corbett. And if you'd like to listen to more episodes, you can catch up by going to BBC Sounds. We've got loads out there now.
Hello, Greg Jenner here, host of You're Dead to Me. In my new family-friendly podcast series, Dead Funny History, historical figures come back to life for just about long enough to argue with me, tell us their life stories, and sometimes get on my nerves. There's 15 lovely episodes to unwrap, including the life of Ramses the Great, Josephine Baker, and the history of football, plus much, much more. So this Christmas, give your ears a treat with Dead Funny History. You can find it in the You're Dead to Me feed on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.